Hello and welcome. I'm Laura Briggs with the Vegan Fitness Runner podcast, where I'll be talking all things running, health and fitness, and what it means to be an active vegan. Ultra running legend and climate campaigner Damien Hall is my guest on this episode of the Vegan Fitness Runner. Damien's just launched a new initiative, Into Ultra, with a small group of ultra runners to make the sport accessible to everyone. He won the Montane Winter Spine earlier this year, completed four loops of the notorious Barclay Marathons, and continues to race in some of the most challenging of the world's ultras, while still flying the flag for the environment and the protection of our planet through initiatives such as the Green Runners and Extinction Rebellion. So hello to you, Damien.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. You must be a very busy man at the moment. You've been doing wonderful things recently. You completed and won the Winter Spine Race, and you've been participating also in the notorious Barclay Marathons. How did you get on with that?
Yeah, it's been quite a busy start to the year. Yeah, the Barclay was fascinating from personal perspective. I felt very lucky to be there. You know, not many people can do that race, and it's notoriously secretive about how you get in and when it is and so on. So I feel very lucky to have the opportunity. And then, yeah, I'm still trying to work out whether I did well or badly. I think I did both. So for those who don't know, it's kind of five loops in the woods in Tennessee, and very few people have completed five loops. I completed four loops, and on my fifth loop, I couldn't find a book. And you have to find pages from books to prove that you've been on the course, because it's unmarked. And I simply couldn't find a book that I had found easily 2 hours ago. And turning back the other direction in a lovely sunny morning as well, but very, very tired by then, two nights without sleep. And yeah, just probably got a bit confused and couldn't find the blasted book.
So what happened? Did you just bail after you couldn't find the book, or did you kind of, you know, take a few moments to have a think about it? Or what was your next step?
Well, yeah, I pretty much did, because two things. I mean, there were 13 books, and you have to get a page from each of those to prove you've done the course. Even if you've lost one, that's not good enough. You've got to bring them all back to camp within the time limit. And that was the other thing. I was running low on time. I think I had just about enough time maybe when I left camp, but I used about an hour looking for that book. And by then it was very unlikely that I would get the rest of the loop done. And I was just very tired. So I started on my way back to camp. And once the sort of the adrenaline of being in the race had gone, I felt very, very tired. And I went for a sleep sort of in the middle of the path, actually. It was quite a quiet area of woods. Slept across the path. Not long later, Jasmine Paris, who is a good friend, came running past, woke me up, and said she had found the book, no problem at all. So there's probably a gender stereotype joke in there about how well men and women look for things, which gets played out in our household as well. So, yeah.
Brilliant.
That still frustrates me and amuses me as well. But, you know.
I mean, even to have managed four loops, Damien, I mean, we're talking Barclay Marathons. Very few people, like you say, actually get invited to run it in the first place. And four loops is pretty damn good going, isn't it? You must be pretty proud of that.
Well, you're very kind. I'm proud and frustrated at the same time. Yeah, statistically, the race has been happening since 1986, although not every single year. But we've had 17 finishers since 1986. And then there are 19 people who have started a fifth loop. And I'm one of the two who have started a fifth loop but have not finished a fifth loop. Although, you know, hopefully I'll get another chance sometime. But yeah, that's still elated company. I'm still, if I don't get another go, I'll still be fairly proud of that. I just felt like that time, you know, I just about had time. It was lovely weather. Laz nearly always makes the course harder once someone's completed it. So next time might not be so straightforward. But, you know, I'm in this for the adventure, you know, and for the stories. And I got so.
You certainly did. And from the kind of sublime to the ridiculous, in one sense, obviously your Barclay race sounds like you had lovely weather for it. Can you tell me about the complete opposite, the Winter Spine, which to me, hating cold weather, just looks like my absolute nightmare?
We had great weather. For winter, it was actually quite nice and cold. So that meant the ground was a lot harder. Actually, the bogs, the Pennine Way's notorious bogs, they weren't all frozen by any means, but the ground was actually a lot harder than it could have been. So when it's sort of a bit warmer, it's all properly soggy and boggy and will slow you up a lot and increase the chance of foot problems and so on. So actually it being hard and cold was actually pretty good. And there was a lot of snow on the ground, so that was beautiful. It possibly got down to about minus 10 at one point, but that with sort of wind chill. But I mean, I do like that sort of stuff. It's really exciting to be out in the British winter and feel like it's, you know, the Arctic or something like that, and feel like, you know, that's again why I do these things, for an adventure. And to be on the Pennine Way, which, you know, has its moments. There are some stunning bits, but there are some quite bleak and unforgiving bits. But just to see it again, see it in so much snow, which I hadn't really seen before, was wonderful. And yeah, when you see the sunrise and the sunset, not all that far between, not all that far away from each other at that time of year. But yeah, I had a wonderful time, honestly did.
You are one of these people who loves the cold. I've got to say, I just can't deal with it. How do you keep yourself warm? You just said it drops down to minus 10. I mean, come on, you must have some tips about how to stay alive in that kind of weather.
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one is keep moving. I mean, quite a lot of the time, I think I do run quite warm in that I seem to create quite a bit of heat compared to some people, maybe. I mean, definitely my hands get very cold very easily, but on my actual body, I don't seem to need the layers that some people do. But yeah, keep moving and keep eating. They're the two big ones. I do often race at that sort of, what's the word, thermoregulation sort of level, where if you do stop for just a couple of minutes, you're going to start getting cold quite quickly. So it kind of keeps you moving. Although I've always got more kit in my bag, but yeah, I think keep moving, keep eating. And obviously a bit of good kit helps as well.
It obviously helps being a quick runner in times like that. You know, if possibly if you're back at the Packer and you are, you know, naturally a slower runner, maybe then you've got to think more about your kit in terms of keeping warm over that kind of terrain.
Yes, maybe. I mean, it's kind of all relative to each person and, yeah, what kit and what how they're moving. I mean, one of the secrets as well is when you get to the checkpoints, you know, they're offering you warm meals, they're offering you hot cups of tea. I mean, you know, take all of that you can. And what's amazing about this race is, one of several things is how much people get behind it, both the staff and just strangers turn up and give you cups of tea. Honestly, it invite you into their homes for cups of tea, which is just, you know, heartwarming and almost genuinely, because there's the warm liquid going down inside you is warming you up, but you get this warm feeling of, wow, people really, I think the madness of the concept of the race, people just get drawn to it. So people really on the route seem to really embrace it. And you get treated, honestly, you get kind of treated like royalty as you run it. It's amazing.
And there really is nothing better than a good cup of tea, is there? I noticed you'd actually put something on your Instagram story today, Damien, about how brilliant a cup of tea was.
Yeah.
You were actually quite late to kind of what I was called the ultra running scene. What was the catalyst that got you into running long distances?
Yeah. I actually did my first half marathon I think it was 2011 when I was 35. I did sign up on a whim. Like, I mean, I've always been, I suppose, fairly sporty. I do love those stories of people who are sort of, I don't know, smoking 40 Marlboro a day and downing 8 cans of Stella, and now they're amazing ultra runners. I love those stories, and I know people like that. It's not quite the lifestyle turnaround from me. I've always been fairly sporty. I love playing football, and I loved trekking and a bit of mountaineering and stuff. So I love being out in the hills and so on. And I suppose the football thing was the more competitive side of it. And the hill walking, you know, it doesn't really feel like a competition. But after my first half marathon, which, yeah, I was just feeling a bit unfit. I lived in Bath, where there's a big half marathon. You know, you see all the posters and so on. So I just kind of signed up. And yeah, loved it. But I realized I loved the training as well. I loved the sense of mission of sort of aiming for something and the discipline it gave me to sort of get out and train. And I don't remember training ever feeling, you know, awful or like a chore. I loved it. And then, very soon afterwards wanted to do it again and wanted to do a marathon. But then around that time, just realized there were trail races and people ran on hills and fells and mountains. It still took a while to realize, I suppose, what were the races. You know, even now, there's not really one website you can go to find out all the races. So it does take a little bit of time to, get to know people. And I suppose this is early days of kind of Facebook and stuff. Maybe it's easier now. And then the next year I did my first marathon and my first ultra marathon and loved that even more. And just straight away thought, this is for me. I'm going to do more of this.
It must have been quite nice to be age 35, just doing something you really loved. And then obviously latterly being kind of supported to do what you love, rather than maybe going through your childhood years, your early teen years, you know, being almost pressurized into doing sports. You've actually just, you do it because you enjoy it. And I think that really comes through.
Yeah, I do feel, again, you definitely find it ultra running and trail running, people who didn't enjoy sport at school, which is, again, just wonderful. And it definitely fits, I think, a certain stage of life. You know, I'd just become a parent, and running is one of those super flexible sport. You know, you can do it on your own for starters. You can do it any time of day, pretty much any terrain, anywhere you are. Whereas before that, I was playing a lot of football and, you know, you can't really play football without other people. You're going to meet a certain time of day and so on. And a match is 2 hours. And some of those things aren't compatible with the early weeks and months of parenthood. So running sort of almost, it really nicely benefited those early years. Early weeks and months for me. And it probably isn't a coincidence that my running journey pretty much mirrors my sort of being a parent as well. They do fit very nicely.
It's true, isn't it, that you have to fit, obviously, you're running around family life. You know, I've got children as well, and fitting it in sometimes can be a little tricky, but actually it is a sport that allows you to do it kind of any time of the day. If you want to get up at 5 a.m. and train, you can. If you want to do it when the children are in bed, it gives you that flexibility. Is that part of what drew you to the sport in the first place?
I think I don't think I recognize that sort of beforehand. I think I just realized that as I got into it. I don't know if it's the same for you, but that for us anyway, when we became parents, like your social life takes quite a hit early on. And also I just found, you know, I used to be quite into films and quite into music. And I just didn't have time for friends, films and music anymore. But what I did realize was I was still making time for my running. Whether it was 6 a.m. or 6 or 7 p.m, my choice was, and I don't even know if it felt like a choice, but all right, you've got an hour or to 2 hours of time to yourself now. What are you going to do? And I would go running. That was more appealing. And I realized, I don't know how I feel about this, but there were times when I could have caught up with a friend who I hadn't seen for months or go for a run. And I was choosing to go for a run. I suppose that's the, you know, if that's how I felt, that was the honest thing to do. But I realized, I was getting, it really mattered to me and I was getting a lot from it. So it became, I think as I settled back down into, you know, you almost reclaim some of your social life over time. I actually wanted to prioritize the running over that. So I've never, I do have something, a small social life now, but it's my running life is much, much bigger.
I mean, I don't know for you, maybe, you know, with children as well, certainly running gives you that mental headspace that you possibly wouldn't get if you went and, you know, went out on a night out or, you know, met up with a group of friends. And do you like particularly running on your own, just getting away from everything?
I think early on that was really helpful because, when you become a parent, you do lose a lot of your own time, don't you? I mean, it's good and bad. I think I realize my previous life seemed quite self-centered. You know, you can kind of do what you want within reason. Whereas when you become a parent, you know, your number one priority, or at least the way I felt, was I've got to look after this person and support them and support family. But running seemed to, it was a little escape. I don't want to say escape from the pressure of that, but it was me time. It was valuable me time. And I would always come back. I still remember those early years. I still think it's true now. Come back happier. If you felt stressed by all sorts of things, so often go for a run and it doesn't solve everything, but it can solve a lot of things. It seems to solve a lot of things, or at least just put things in perspective, come back with good ideas as well. it just, yeah, it's sort of is my meditation, as it is for a lot of people, I think.
For sure. And a lot of people have said to me in the past, and I tend to agree, that actually a happy parent means happy children, because you are more patient with them and you're in a better frame of mind to listen and yeah, just generally parent better, I think. Talking of, you know, becoming a parent and having children, let's talk a little bit now, if we can, about your, you know, your ethical stance and becoming a campaigner and an activist. You founded a group called the Green Runners, didn't you, Damien? Can you maybe talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely co-founding. There were probably 12 of us. We've been talking in a WhatsApp group for quite a long time. I'd sort of collected together all the, I suppose the runners were mostly in trail and ultra running and fell running, but anyone I noticed who had sort of spoken out or made any gestures towards concerns for our climate and ecological emergency, or people I knew who had been to Extinction Rebellion protests like me, I sort of gathered them together. It took a while to realize, you know, to sort of work out what to do. But then a great runner who's a friend who I coach as well, AJ Hanspell, he just sort of said one day, why don't we form a club? And it was like, oh yeah, that's the most simplest and obvious thing to do. So just over a year ago now, we launched the Green Runners with four pillars. And this is based on, I suppose, what I found in researching my book, but also we have, you know, sustainability professionals in the group, and even climate researchers and scientists. Four pillars, sort of, yeah, how we move, how we eat, how we kit up, because for most individuals, those three aspects will be the biggest sections of their sort of personal footprint. But for me, the most important one is the fourth one, how we speak up, or I suppose you could see it as how you act. And that means really sort of nudging for system change, nudging for bigger changes, which to me is more important than your personal footprint, which, I mean, that's still important. And I've made big changes there. But all of us, you know, making sure we wash up our hummus pots for recycling, that's fine. Unless, you know, if someone opens a coal mine down the road, you know, that we took our eyes off the prize. That wasn't the right, you know, we were obsessing over the wrong thing. So nudging for wider change is to me much more significant and important.
So I've been reading your book, We Can't Run Away From This. You know, I'm really interested in this topic anyway. Saving our planet is, you know, and has to be the utmost priority for all of us, I think. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a heavy read for me. It makes me feel so guilty.
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
No, I am sorry about that. I think you're possibly, I don't know if you're still in the sportswear section, but that's definitely the worst. and I just, but the more I dug, the worse things got. And it's just so depressing I suppose if you look at the fashion industry overall, or the clothing industry, however you want to spin it, and obviously sportswear is a big part of that. Yeah, there's just so much damage caused on so many levels. Even, for example, in the cotton industry, there's still slave labor and child labor. That's well established. It doesn't mean, you know, our T-shirts are necessarily made in that way, but often you can't be sure. And then all the forever chemicals and microplastics, microfibers, it's just depressing. And then all the waste. It was really, it's hard to, it's hard to almost talk about. And I got really fed up doing those chapters. If I did the book again, I'd put them further at the back so that it didn't hit people too early on. But that's kind of what I mean, where, you know, you making a, so one of the outcome, one of the sort of solutions is we've just all got to buy less kit and make it last longer. But really those companies can obviously make such bigger changes than we can as individuals. So really it's, you know, trying to tell companies, hold on, we don't think you should make a new version of that shoe yet, because, you know, the old version was perfectly good. That sort of stuff, the overconsumption crisis. That side of things is really shocking, really. So I didn't want to make people feel guilty. And I try towards the end of the book to get away from the idea that it's all on us as individuals, because certainly someone in the book who works in sportswear said, I feel guilty for existing. And we shouldn't, you know, it's not our fault, a lot of this. And in fact, almost none of it is our fault. It's big oil and big agriculture, and you could say sort of fast fashion. Those industries have known for a while. Big oil has known for decades what they're doing. And they've tried to cover it up and stuff like that. So, I mean, they're the ones who are guilty, not us as individuals who have tiny footprints in comparison.
And actually, when I say to you, it's, you know, I don't mean this to be negative, a depressing read. I only mean that I think we're reading a truth, aren't we? And it's, we often try and gloss over the scary stuff. The fact is that this is happening to our planet and it is scary, but unless we actually confront it head on, then there won't be any change. You want people to speak out. And I think the way you've written this book actually makes, well, certainly from a personal point of view, it makes me feel really angry and it makes me want to speak about it more. There's a statistic within the sportswear section that keeps sticking in my head. And I've told a few people about it. And they said, oh, that can't be true. That can't be true. Which is the stat that in the UK alone, every year we throw away 300 million pairs of trainers. That blew my mind. I mean, that is insane. Yeah. What happens to those trainers? Tell everybody.
Well, exactly. Yeah, it's stunning, isn't it? And then if you think in the running world, we're encouraged to throw our trainers away after even 300 miles. In fact, an athlete of mine just this week was seeing a doctor, and he said, "Oh, you should throw them out after 200 miles." And it's like, no, there's actually no evidence that our shoes injure us. I would say after, you know, 1500, 2000 miles, sometimes it's, if you're running on tarmac, sometimes it might be smart to move on. But yeah, those shoes are all made from plastic. They're all made, which is oil, which is fossil fuels. And they're not biodegradable 99% of the time, so or recyclable. So they either get burnt, which adds to the problem, because that releases not just greenhouse gases, but you know, toxic, noxious gases that you know causes great harm, and add to the problem as or they go into landfill, which also adds to the problem because that releases methane and other greenhouse gases. So either way, they're adding to the problem, and we're throwing all these clothes and shoes out all the time. So that's what I mean by sort of overconsumption, I suppose, that too much stuff is being made, too much stuff is being bought. And then, of course, we're often maybe throwing them out prematurely. So, yeah, it's pretty gloomy stuff, isn't it?
It's heavy stuff. And also, I mean, I never kind of, well, I don't have it in my mind about this shoe, but you wrote about a shoe that Nike brought out that was actually named like the race day shoe, and the whole marketing, you know, ploy behind it was that you would just wear these shoes to race in and then get rid of them because then they, you know, had their one use or however many uses it was, not very many. So they were actively encouraging, like you say, consumers to throw things away. And that is where you think the responsibility has to land on the manufacturer's shoulders here, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And Nike are by far the biggest sportswear company in the world, certainly when it comes to running shoes. Adidas is second, and they're more European based, but they're like half the size of Nike, and then a lot of the other companies are much smaller again. So Nike, I mean, they can just have so much impact. They're so influential, and I mean, if you go on their website, they make all sorts of claims towards, you know, sustainability and recycling and so on, which, you know, observers have been cynical about for a while. But also they've been open about the fact they're trying to double their business. So, you know, if you're doubling your business, you're trying to make twice as many items of clothing and shoes. And that's all the emissions. Whenever anything's created, there are emissions, usually from the energy. Usually it's in Asia, and there's very little renewable energy there at the moment. So, they're massively adding to the problem while on the website claiming to be part of the solution. And that's, you know, that's greenwashing, and that's part of the problem in sportswear again, because it's so confusing for consumers, because that people are saying, oh, it's got, you know, plastic from the ocean in, or there's shoes now made from mushroom and sugarcane, and so on, recycled plastic bottles, blah blah blah. But really, if you're just making and making stuff, and if that stuff doesn't last, then you're only adding to the problem. You're not improving things. So yeah, really frustrating, but hopefully the messages getting out about these brands, and hopefully they will do much, much better.
Absolutely. And on a kind of personal level, a lower level for just us runners as a smaller cog in the big wheel, what can we do individually? I know there's no silver bullet here, but you know, you've just said buy less. I mean, that's a great starting point, isn't it? But is there anything else we can do that really will help our planet?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, so you've got, you almost, there is some overlap, but you almost draw a line between the two. So you've got sort of personal footprint, pun not intended, reductions, and then you've got nudging for system change, I suppose, pushing for wider change. Now, I would say if you've got 5 or 10 minutes spare in your week, nudge for system change. So that means, you know, if there's a brand you're loyal to or you like, or if you just want to pick on Nike, which I applaud, you know, email them and say, you know, what are you doing? It doesn't look like you're doing much. It looks like you're creating lots of waste. You're creating lots of pollution. What are you doing? How are you going to improve? Maybe do it publicly on social media. If you've got the courage, I appreciate not everyone has. But then in a wider context, it's, you know, vote the right way when you get a chance. Sign up to all sorts of organizations like the Green Runners being the obvious one, but things like Greenpeace. I mean, personally, I think Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil and Insulate Britain are all amazing. And if you don't want to get too involved, you know, can you support them financially a little bit? Those sort of wider societal things. You can join campaigns. If you sign up for like Greenpeace, they really keep you in the loop with sort of, I suppose, what people call clicktivism, which is still useful, but, you know, it might be emailing your MP at certain times to make sure, you know, to try and encourage them to vote certain ways when a bill comes up. That sort of stuff can be really important. If you want to keep within running, it's, yeah, join the Green Runners, join this Protect Our Winters, a pretty good group, started off in America, but they've got a European branch now. They're well informed and doing the right things. It might be in your local running club. It might be sort of saying, how can we make our events or races more sustainable, which will usually mean looking at participant travel first. How are people getting to the races? That will usually be the biggest thing. But maybe, you know, maybe your club's races don't need all those T-shirts and medals is a classic one, or all those water bottles. I would say, yeah, try and do those things. It could be in your workplace. I would say concentrate on those things at home for you individually. Yeah, I mean, someone's individual footprint is usually split four ways. It's your travel. So, yeah, reducing flights or single occupant car journeys, they're the big ones if you can. But no one's expecting everyone to give those up entirely. You know, how you eat, red meat and, well, all meat and dairy are a big part of the problem. So reducing there is great. Your energy for your home is quite an easy one to change now that the sort of energy crisis is lessening, and it's just switching to a renewable energy supplier such as Ecotricity. Can even be cheaper sometimes. That's a nice, simple, yeah, a nice quick one. You can do it online in a few minutes, maybe even save money. And the last one for personal footprint is simply what you buy, which ties back into running. So it probably does mean buying less and making it last. Yeah, I mean, those are the main things to think about.
There's a lot of things to think about, and yeah, any one of those, you know, or a few of those is better than doing nothing, isn't it? You are obviously, Damien, really genned up on all of this information. There's so much to take in. There's a lot of scary stuff, like we said before, but there's also a few positives. Do you still feel, even with all this knowledge and, you know, you've written this book, do you still feel a huge pressure to consume?
No. I feel pressure the other way, to be honest, to be sort of, not perfect, but to be, I mean, we discussed the Barclay Marathons and it's in America, so I did fly there. It was my only flight for running in 4 years. But I felt really uneasy, I suppose, really conflicted about doing that. I mean, I've rationalized it in a way that I'm okay with it, in that that race was absolutely top of, you know, my sort of running experiences I could have in the world. It mattered a lot to me. I tried to make everything I could out of the trip, which is sort of advice from Mike Berners-Lee. And there just wasn't a realistic alternative to flying to America. There are some boats that go, but I do want to see my kids occasionally. But I would rather have not flown. But I think it also helps because, I mean, yeah, not everyone agrees on this, but like imperfect activism is the only way, really. Like none of us are going to be perfect. No one is really going to give up all flying or single occupant car journeys and give up all meat and dairy and never buy any new running kit. Like that's not fair to ask of people, and realistic, is it? So what I'm happy to sort of be a bit of a fool guy and show, look, I'll bang on about this stuff. And yeah, every now and then I might fly to my dream race. I've massively reduced my footprint. I used to fly probably 3 times on average a year to races abroad. Now I've realized a lot of those I could have just got the train. So I do in Europe. So I don't mind being, you know, a bit of an imperfect idiot, I suppose. If hopefully it shows, because if you make it like a perfect thing, as in, yeah, as in you give up everything and that's the way forward, then A, you know, most people aren't going to come on board with it, because they'll be like, well, why should I, you know, give up all my beef burgers or not ever buy new shoes again? We're not going to actually get people on board, and it's not just not realistic or fair, I don't think. So I think we have to pursue this sort of imperfect activism. I don't mind being a hypocrite. Like, yeah, it's too late not to be. It's too urgent. But, I still feel like people don't realize how urgent this stuff is. The heat in the sea at the moment is at record levels, and it isn't getting reported in the mainstream media. It's really frightening. So it's too late to be perfect. I guess that's my angle.
Do you think that people are put off a little bit by perhaps worrying they're going to do it wrong?
Yes.
You know, people I know, just on a purely a vegan, you know, route, have said to me, oh, I'm really worried because, you know, I'm going to give up this and this, but what happens if I don't manage it? Or what happens if I accidentally eat a piece of cheese, you know, to put it on a basic level? And people set themselves up that they expect themselves to be 100% perfect. And that's not the case, is it? It's having a go is better.
Yes, definitely. We there's a nice phrase, kind of progress, not perfection, because perfection just isn't possible. And 100%, I see that fear of perfection in other runners, both sort of recreational runners and elite runners, who they're afraid, they don't speak out on social media, even though they're doing sort of very conscientious things in their lives. They don't speak out on social media because they still might take a flight or maybe two in a year. And they don't, I suppose they don't want to be called a hypocrite, I suppose. And then I see it in brands and races, that they haven't acted publicly on something. They haven't made a gesture because they haven't quite got it right yet. And they're looking for the perfect thing. And I do totally get that. I just think it's sort of, yeah, too late to be perfect. And, We've got to try. We've got to act. I think that fear of perfection is definitely holding people back.
And I think also in the day of social media, people perhaps are scared to put things online because they open themselves up as well to criticism, don't they? You know, you can say, oh, I'm being an activist. I'm not taking any flights, and then there'll always be somebody out there just to kind of really, you know, scan your every movement and then pick you up when you get it wrong. And I think possibly people are scared of that too. It's like being, you know, constantly monitored for putting a step wrong. Do you think that's a pressure on you as well with social media?
Yeah. Yeah, no, 100%. I know someone who does amazing, I won't name them, but she, the person does amazing things, is right at the forefront of this, but is terrified to like drive her car locally because she thinks someone will see her driving a car and then they'll call her a hypocrite. And I totally get that, because I have almost, yeah, a kind of similar, well, not a similar fear, because I'm kind of over it in a way. Here's what I tell myself. My biggest fear is my kids. So we've got a chance now. Like, we have to reduce, scientists say we have to reduce global emissions by 45% this decade, and they're still going up. They're the highest they've ever been. They're going up. And Sir David King, the former chief scientific advisor to the government, said what we do in the next 3 or 4 years is crucial to the future of humankind on this planet. And he said that 2 years ago. So right now is the time. It's not in 5 or 10 years. It's right now. And my kids and their kids and all of our kids are going to turn around to us most likely in 20 years and go, you knew what was happening. You knew what would happen if you didn't do anything, and you didn't do anything. Like, why didn't you do anything? And I, you know, I'm going to hopefully be able to say, look, I tried, I did these things. And there'll be some other people who will go, oh, well, I pointed out some other people's inaccuracies on social media and called them a hypocrite. And I just wonder how they'll feel. I just wonder how they'll feel in 20 years.
That's a good way of looking at it, for sure. I've been thinking about how your kids feel, yeah.
Yeah, because they're going to look on our generation, I think, as, lazy and selfish and self-interested. I don't always feel optimistic about whether we'll turn things around, and that's how I think it'll be. I would say to anyone, ask yourself, are you going to be able to look your kids, I suppose, this is a bit strong, but like, are you going to be able to look your kids in the eye and say, we did what we could? So that's what drives me, I suppose.
And there's actually no better driver, really, is there, than our future generations. I have to say, I feel like we've all been really complacent up until now. You know, I know a few years back we were kind of really getting to grips with just how massive this problem was, but still it feels like we're just dragging our heels, you know, governments and as individuals as well. I know that personally we can only do so much by ourselves, but as a group we can do much, much more. And you're right, we want to leave this planet in a better place than how it's been left. And 2 years does not seem like a very long time to turn things around. Are you really scared about not being able to do that?
Yeah. It doesn't look good. It doesn't look like it's likely to happen, if I'm honest. We're likely to hit 1.5 in a few years, scientists say. We can't be sure when, and we probably only know kind of afterwards. It does. And that will affect different places on the planet differently. It's not like everywhere on the planet increases by 1.5. Some places will increase by much more than that, and some places less. It's the average. But we already see lots of extreme weather in Britain that we didn't used to have, and several studies have shown, you know, it's far, the extreme weather, the changeable weather is far more likely now and caused by, you know, human induced climate breakdown. So it doesn't feel that likely. It's mostly big oil, and our government still subsidizes big oil and is still opening up, allowing, you know, big oil projects in the North Sea. When UN scientists are saying, you know, we must stop, the International Energy Agency says we must stop, we must not have any new gas, oil and coal exploration, and they're still going ahead. So yeah, that's when you feel a bit helpless. But I honestly, one of the main things is to talk about it, because that's what one of my favorite climate scientists, Catherine Hayhoe, the Canadian, excellently named Canadian, says, yeah, that's the number one thing we should do is keep talking about it. So that's what we're doing.
You're doing a brilliant job. I'm wondering if that is a positive thing that you're doing. Is there something positive that you can give the listeners from all of this, after the doom and gloom of what, you know, the tragedy of what we're doing to our planet? What keeps you motivated? What keeps you positive off the back of all of this?
Well, hopefully you'll stick with my book, and it does get you're definitely in the gloomiest bit, I think, and it does get more positive towards the end, partly because I realized running is already doing some good things, both individuals and brands and races. We're a bit late in the day, but there are some really inspiring and encouraging things happening. And I suppose the more we can spread the word about those, the more we can celebrate and support those things, the better. I really hope running, what we're seeing within running is it's the sort of trail and off-road and ultra running that is leading the way a little bit. And then hopefully that can spread to running, and hopefully running can be a leader, maybe other sports can follow. I'd say football, for example, is a much massively bigger sport globally, but is probably a little behind. Hopefully, you know, and sport is so influential, because we nearly all play it or watch it in some way. So it can have a huge impact, and it is being affected as well, in lots of different ways. But yeah, I think sport can be such a powerful thing, and I think it can be used to make huge, huge gains in the right direction.
Excellent. And Damien, in terms of your running, what do you see going forward for you? What are your next challenges? What are you looking forward to with your running?
I guess I did sort of pledge a year or two ago, if it's not obvious, that like really my running would be about trying to sort of, I suppose, spread awareness of our climate and ecological emergency. But hopefully it doesn't all have to be, which is a good moment actually to plug. We have another climate relay coming up called the Out of Time relay in June and July, which is running from Ben Nevis to Big Ben in London, Ben to Ben. I might have to quickly find the website for you. I don't know how many people. There was a brilliant relay last year, which we got involved with to sort of to celebrate COP27. There's something similar happening this year. People can go on the website and sign up to run or cycle a stage. So it was really, really great thing to be a part of last time and did belatedly get some media attention. So what's great about that is, you know, for people who struggle with how do we sort of make a difference, you know, the best way to do that is to, you know, almost go run, you know, go running. And this is a chance to just run. And then that becomes a form of activism. And hopefully the more people that sign up, of course, the more coverage you might get. I might have to forward you the website afterwards.
We can share the website, absolutely.
That'd be brilliant. Thank you.
The listeners.
That's happening in June and July. And yeah, personally, I've got two more races this year. They are both abroad, but they're both reachable by public transport, thankfully. The big one for me is the Tour de Gion in Italy, which I did last year and just loved. In September, it's a big loop of the Italian Alps. So looking forward to that most of all. That's that should be fun.
It sounds beautiful as well. Do you go out there with the aim to podium, or do you just do it because you love it now?
Hey, yeah, I do. I do want to do the best I can. But what you find is, and this is backed up by sports psychologists as well, is, you know, if you're obsessed with winning, you probably won't win. It's usually people who are thinking you've got to think more about the process and the enjoyment. Now, of course, within that, I've got some competitive natures that it's hard to quieten down sometimes. But I did it last year and I just absolutely loved it. I placed 12th, but I felt I could do better. But it's not the end. If I don't do better, it's not the end of the world. I just, you know, I'm there equally to have a brilliant time.
Well, you're a phenomenal runner, we know that, but you're also a phenomenal activist for our environment and for our planet, which is just the most important thing in this day and age. I really feel that. And it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Damien. As I say, I know you're really busy, so I really appreciate you giving up the time to talk to me on the podcast today. I've signed up for the Green Runners, and I would encourage all of the listeners to do the same so that we can all do our bit. Thank you again, Damien. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks for your kind words. And yeah, thanks for helping spread the message.
Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave a review for the Vegan Fitness Runner podcast. Please subscribe if you don't want to miss an episode. And remember, you can find out more about all my guests and further information on all the topics covered over on the website, veganfitnessrunner.com. Thanks again, and bye for now.